here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Thanks to Tim, generating new music yet again. And now, welcome to Evening Under Lamplight. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and this is Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. We're here on the second show in our fifth series, following on from last time when we looked at Wednesday and middleness and the messiness that seems always to accompany us when we're lost in the middle of things. We left the last show still stuck in the middle with you having more to say about this Wednesday moment. In particular, we have to attend for a bit to the god of Wednesday and all things middle, the god Hermes or Mercury. So let's see what we can see. You are invited to attend. Interruptions are part of this confusion in the middle of things, part of the Hermes moment, and here comes our first interruption. I wanted to speak about this last time, but there wasn't room, so it got deferred until this evening under lamplight. I wanted to go back to the few lines from T.S. Eliot that give us the title of our show, Evening Under Lamplight. It's always good to review this passage from Four Quartets. Four Quartets is not an easy poem. We aren't really meant to sit there and work out the meaning of each line, but to attend to the lines and their imagery and pacing and let them work on us over and over. So let me read this 20-line passage at the end of the East Coker's section of the poem. Just move along with the lines and catch what you can, or better yet, let the lines reach out and catch you, as a few of the words, but not all of them, are bound to do. Home is where one starts from. As we grow older, the world becomes stranger, the pattern more complicated of dead and living. Not the intense moment isolated with no before and after, but a lifetime burning in every moment. And not the lifetime of one man only, but of old stones that cannot be deciphered. There is a time for the evening under starlight, a time for the evening under lamplight, the evening with the photograph album. Love is most nearly itself, when here and now cease to matter. Old men ought to be explorers. Here and there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion through the dark, cold, and empty desolation, the wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters of the petrel and the porpoise. In my end is my beginning. Now, I'd intended to spend a few minutes trying to open up some of these lines, but when I came to speak about them, I discovered that I actually couldn't explain what was going on. I think I used to be able to, but not this time. But that's all right. The meaning comes and goes. The imagery is what can haunt us and reverberate within us. So let's leave it at that. No, let's leave it at this. Here's Alec Guinness reading the lines. No one does it better than he.
Home is where one starts from. As we grow older, the world becomes stranger, the pattern more complicated of dead and living. Not the intense moment isolated with no before and after, but a lifetime burning in every moment, and not the lifetime of one man only, but of old stones that cannot be deciphered. There is a time for the evening under starlight, a time for the evening under lamplight, the evening with the photograph album. Love is most nearly itself when here and now cease to matter. Old men ought to be explorers. Here and there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion through the dark cold and the empty desolation, the wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters of the petrel and the porpoise. In my end is my beginning.
It takes some guts to set my own reading up against Alec Guinness's, but that's what I've done. So let us now be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion. A deeper communion with this wayward, disconcerting, but ultimately benign god Hermes. So, who is this god of Wednesday, dies mercurii, mercoledì, mercredi, miércoles? Well, for one thing, he's not really a god in the sense of someone we today want to worship and offer sacrifices to. He's more like the embodiment of certain forces or principles of the universe, a whole assortment of forces that the Greeks recognized were somehow related and working together in our human life, and which we can establish a relationship with by giving them a name, so we have a better idea of what we're dealing with. To treat Hermes as a real person is to be too literal, and that's precisely what Hermes does not allow, as we'll see in a few minutes. Hermes, I think you'll see, is both intensely attractive and also a little frightening. He comes to us to transform us, after all, to push us out of our ego self and out of the everyday world we take for granted into what Joseph Campbell calls a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms. And finally, out of that, into a new, rich, wonderful existence. When we are under the influence of Hermes, we can say that we have entered the Hermes field, or have opened ourselves to hermetic consciousness. This is a world, a consciousness, removed from our everyday world. In the Hermes field, things like things like getting the kids to the after-school activities isn't really that important, or even things like brushing your hair, or making sure your buttons are straight, or succeeding in the big business deal you've been working on for several months. It's not so important. The news they feed us on the media is not of this Hermes world either, and often Hermes teaches us that the plans we have projected for ourselves are irrelevant too. All the things the ego is so wrapped up in are inconsequential, unless they can be made to help our transformation beyond the ego. One of Hermes' names, or one of his jobs, is the psychopomp, the guide of the soul after death down to the underworld. Of course, these things have to be taken on many levels, and what's most important to us here is the way this underworld is, in fact, our unconscious. Hermes, through his tricks and diversions, leads us down to our unconscious selves, where we learn what we knew all along. We think we have lost all control and have died, but in our end is our beginning, and we come out with greater self-knowledge and wisdom, greater strength and connection to the best in life. Hermes is also the onekopomp, the guide of the dream world. Dreams, of course, are bringing us messages from our unconscious, so you see how it's all related. And when the ancient people tried to find appropriate images for this aspect of life, they pictured Hermes at crossroads and gateways, at turning points on the road, reading these as metaphors for the turning points in our lives, like the times we are humiliated, and through the devastation we suddenly see the world in a clearer light, or the times you are, say, at a party and happen to meet someone who happens to mention that he or she is looking for someone to fill a new opening at work, and you realize, even though you'd never thought of this before, that you'd not only be good at that job, but would also be fulfilled. And this reminds me of the Hermes moment when I was prompted to start doing a radio show. I don't think I've ever told this story on air. Well, this was, I think, in 2008. And there was a program on 209 Radio, the community radio in Cambridge at the time, a Friday afternoon show that sometimes featured a small panel of people talking about a particular topic. This Friday, there were three people there to talk about dreams, and one of my friends, a psychotherapist, was invited to be on the panel. But in the end, she discovered she couldn't make it and suggested they get in touch with me. Yeah, sure, I could do it, and I prepared some stuff to say, but here's the real moment. Sitting in the green-walled studio, like being submerged in a Hermes cave, I distinctly remember looking around and saying to myself, I could do this. Or maybe it was Hermes saying it to me. A crossroads opening me to something my conscious mind would never have thought of. Then came the everyday things, like learning how to operate the studio and preparing the material for the first show, and of course, finding a name for the show, sitting there one evening, putting everything else aside, hoping for some guidance to the right phrase. Should the title be a line from Dylan? Maybe I could still dig out that list of potential lines for the title of the show. And then I went to the shelves of poetry books, and suddenly I knew T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets would give me the title. I flipped through the pages of this small book, and Evening Under Lamplight, in the passage we've just heard, leapt out at me, Hermes again guiding me. I was in a sacred place, a Hermes field, away from all other concerns. Now here, for a little break from my voice, is Joseph Campbell with Bill Moyers talking about the need for each of us to create a sacred place or a sacred space, as the Plains Indians did in their whole world.
What does it mean to have a sacred place?
This is a term I like to use now as an absolute necessity for anybody today. You must have a room or a certain hour a day or so where you do not know what was in the newspapers that morning. You don't know who your friends are. You don't know what you owe to anybody. You don't know what anybody owes to you. But a place where you can simply experience and bring forth what you are and what you might be. This is the place of creative incubation. And at first you may find that nothing's happening there. But if you have a sacred place and use it and take advantage of it, something will happen.
This place does for you what the plains did for the hunter.
For them, the whole thing was a sacred place, do you see? But most of our action is economically or socially determined and does not come out of our life. I don't know whether you've had the experience I've had, but As you get older, the claims of the environment upon you are so great that you hardly know where the hell you are. What is it you intended? You're always doing something that is required of you. This minute, that minute, another minute. Where is your bliss station, you know? Mm. Try to find it. Get a phonograph and put on the records the music that you really love. Even if it's corny music that nobody else respects. I mean, the one that you like or the book you want to read. Get it done and have a place in which to do it. You get the thou feeling of life. These people had it for the whole world that they were living in.
Thank you very much, Joseph Campbell, who says we should find or create our own sacred space. But actually, the Hermes myth tells us that if we don't find it, because we're too preoccupied with worldly things or too unlettered in spiritual mythology or whatever, if we don't find our sacred space, Hermes is going to come along and shove us into one. Maybe then we'll wake up. But maybe not. He'll try again, though. Don't worry. I just mentioned a minute ago that the studio at 209 Radio felt like a kind of submerged cave, isolated from the world. Well, in one sense, of course, it was a radio studio that had to be insulated against outside sounds. But also, as I recall, there was a high ceiling, perhaps even higher than the space on the floor, or maybe I'm just imagining it. And this made it feel like some sort of subterranean pit. And that, too, you see, is appropriate to Hermes, who from his earliest days, so the myth relates, was associated with caves. And that makes sense, too, since caves, pits, dark, hidden places are just the locations suitable for a trickster who surprises us and who pulls us out of the sunlit everyday world. I ought to add, though, that our main studio here at Cambridge 105 does not feel like a subterranean pit. The room is larger, for one thing, and there are large windows across one wall that, at least in the daytime, give an expansive view of the sky, if not also, if you're standing up, of the car park and the Mill Road Cemetery. So, are we here in a Hermes field? Well, perhaps that's not for me to answer here now. So to understand Hermes' cave connections, let's run through the events of his first day or two of life, as related in the Homeric Hymn of Hermes, an ancient Greek religious hymn, but actually more like a short story, or even a mini-epic or epic parody. We begin with Maia, a daughter of the Titan Atlas, who for some reason I've never understood, took to living alone in a dark cave. Though she was hidden, Zeus, the all-seeing, saw her, desired her, and, as was his wont, came down and had her in the dead of night in this dark cave, so as to be hidden from his wife Hera, who was asleep now up on Mount Olympus. Out of this encounter came the child Hermes, born in that same cave. Now, on the very day that he was born, while Maia was resting from giving birth, Hermes got up out of his cradle and wandered off. You can see that this is not a realistic story, though it doesn't keep it from being a true story. Outside the cave, baby Hermes came across a tortoise with the most beautiful shell. "You know," he said to the tortoise, I can make you even more beautiful than you are. Are you willing to let me do this?" Oh, yes, that would be lovely," said the tortoise. And so Hermes deftly killed the tortoise, scooped out its shell, and made a musical instrument, a lyre, L-Y-R-E, made a lyre out of it, using its guts for the strings. And yes, indeed, Hermes had spoken truth. Now the tortoise was even more beautiful. Well, in a sense, anyway. Because not only was there that gorgeous tortoise shell to look at, but also the harmonious music resonating from within that shell, a double beauty. And that's what a lyre sounds like. We just heard Michael Levy playing on a lyre made according to the ancient model, with the first Delphic hymn to Apollo, a piece of music that musical historians have discovered coming from around 138 BCE. But if the lyre was associated with Hermes, how did it get to be playing a hymn to another god, to Apollo? Well, watch and see. Apollo enters the story right about now. After Hermes amused himself making a musical instrument out of a tortoise shell, and thus incidentally becoming a god of craftsmanship, twisting material into other uses, he wandered off and came across a beautiful herd of cattle. They happened to belong to the god Apollo, who, also a son of Zeus, was Hermes' half-brother. Hermes looked around and saw that there was no one near, and then led the cattle away, magically turning their hooves backwards so that their tracks would lead away from the place he was taking his stolen goods to, that is, into a deep cave nearby. Of course, a cave. And thus Hermes becomes the god of thieves and also the god of herds. On the way, he also slaughtered one of the cows and built a fire to cook the meat and made shoes from the hide, thus associating himself with butchers, cooks, and shoemakers. Apollo knew it was his baby brother who had stolen his cattle and rushed over to Maia's cave, where Hermes had returned, wrapped himself in swaddling clothes, and climbed back into the cradle. "What have you done with my cattle?" "Me?" innocently asked Hermes. "I'm just a little newborn baby. I don't even know what a cattle is." Apollo, god of prophecy and deep vision, of course knew Hermes was lying and dragged him up to their father Zeus, demanding that Hermes give back the cattle. Hermes persisted in lying, but Zeus also saw through it and, with an indulgent chuckle, told him to give back the cattle to Apollo. All right, so he did. It was just a game, after all. But then Hermes showed Apollo his beautiful new lyre, and Apollo, god of musical harmony, admired it so much that he told Hermes he could keep the cattle if he let him have that lyre, and so they made a deal, and that was that. Hermes, the god also of deal-making. Apollo and Hermes were often associated together after this, symbolically illustrating the cooperation between the wit of craftsmanship and manipulation and the insight of harmony that comes from Apollo, both parts necessary for the creation of true art. And there, you see, is how Hermes gets to be associated with caves and how Apollo gets to be hymned on a lyre, and how arts of all kinds come under their patronage. But there are also ways in which Hermes and Apollo can stand for two different approaches to life. Apollo can symbolize inspiration. His daughters are the Muses. His other name is Phoebus, which means shining. He's a sun god, and that shining, piercing light is the light of inspiration, coming directly at us, giving us clarity of vision, scientific proof, rational discourse. But Hermes comes through hints and guesses, through nuances and twisted avenues, synchronicity, dead ends, through context and metaphor that is lying in a different sense. He speaks truth to us through the arts. Robert Frost had him in mind when he famously said that poetry is the only acceptable way to say one thing and mean another. In other words, poetry is the acceptable form of lying or feigning, since we know it's not a vicious lie, just a game we're invited to join in. In fact, Hermes, we might say, is always a threat to earnest, literal-minded people. But he's a playmate to those who see it as a game. Leela in Sanskrit. A game we're invited to play as God played with Dame Wisdom at the creation of the world. It's a game with certain requirements and with rich rewards. We have to be willing to enter that dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms, where we surrender control. Or as we heard Eliot tell us, we must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion through the dark, cold, and empty desolation. Well, let's close this part of the discussion with some words from Dennis William Hawke on hermetic consciousness. The hermetic state of consciousness opens doors that Apollonian consciousness does not even know exist. The search for the highest truths begins by hermetically sealing the mind from outside influences, so a person achieves true objectivity by separation from ego prejudice and illusion. Only from this centered viewpoint can true reality be perceived, and no learning can take place, no truth can be expressed, unless this Hermes field prevails. Leonard Cohen knew this place, where many of his songs are set. Here's A Thousand Kisses Deep, where the Hermes field is called Boogie Street, a place where you find yourself not just lost, but losing. You ditch everything just to stay alive. The music has that eerie, deep Hermes feel to it, and see if you can attend to the lyrics. Each image is an aspect of Hermes.
The ponies run, the girls are young. The odds are there to beat. You win a while, and then it's done. Your little winning streak. And summer now to deal with your invincible defeat. Live your life as if it's real. A thousand kisses deep. I'm turning tricks. I'm getting fixed. I'm back on Boogie Street. You lose your grip. Masterpiece. And maybe I had miles to drive and promises to keep. You ditch it all stay alive. A thousand kisses deep.
Leonard Cohen's Hymn to Hermes with Your Invincible Defeats, A Thousand Kisses Deep. You win a while and then it's done, your little winning streak. You lose your grip and then you slip into the masterpiece, consenting to be wrecked. But notice kisses are running through the song, the benevolent blessings. And let us share these benevolent blessings, we who've joined together to form this community here on Community Radio, Cambridge 105, our community gathered in the evening under lamplight, you and me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, and all the others of our group whom we don't see, but we are joined to through that mysterious Hermes mechanics of airwaves and internet waves.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
Thank you. I've been talking about the Hermes field. But what's that all about? Here's something Robert Bly tells us about it. When we are in Hermes field, Bly says, messages pass with fantastic speed between the brain and the fingertips, between the heart and the tear ducts, between the genitals and the eyes, between the part of us that suffers and the part of us that laughs. Hermes is Mercury, and we know that Mercury cannot be held in the hand. It rolls everywhere, separates into tiny drops, joins again, falls on the floor, rolls under the table, moves with amazing quickness. It is correctly called quicksilver. Sometimes when friends are talking in a closed room, the heat of conversation begins to increase. Witty things are said, contributions flow from all sides, leaps of imagination appear, the genuinely spiritual follows an instant after the genuinely obscene. Hermes has arrived. At some beautiful moment of the conversation, a silence falls that feels mysterious. Everyone hesitates to break it. In Spain, until the 15th century, that silence was called Hermes silence. Hermes slips in true information in that split second between the moment your tongue starts and the moment it finishes. Hermes moves faster than our thought. What people call a Freudian slip is really a Hermes precision. Hermes punctures pomposity, piety, sureness, self-satisfaction. And how do we enter the Hermes field? Asks Dennis William Hawke. Well, first, he says, we have to get beyond our own egos and gender styles. That means not engaging in masculine pissing contests or feminine drama and self-martyrdom. Hermetic arguments are exchanges of inspiration and insight geared toward exposing the bare truth of a situation. Thought here is never designed to enhance one's position, to make someone look better or worse than someone else. It's not designed to support someone's belief system or to score points in the art of argument. Conversations, thoughts, and meditative sessions taking place in a Hermes field are marked by a quiet expectation and gentle persuasion that results in a session of flowing truth. In other words, to be in the Hermes field means essentially to be open.
Thank you.
open to spirit, open to the changing wind. Open to touch, open to nature, open to the worlds within. Open to change, open to adventure, open.
That was the Waterboys, or rather, I think pretty much just Mike Scott, with Open, which seems to me to be the password to the Hermes field. Hermes invites us to open the new, or shakes us up until we open to what's before us or within us. That quiet expectation and gentle persuasion, as Hawk puts it, that results in a sensation of flowing truth. And maybe this is an appropriate time to make mention of a series of comments I received recently on the Moments Under Lamplight Facebook wall. Comments relating to the archive of the final Dante episode, When Hell Freezes Over. The episode when I covered the final three cantos of the Inferno. The picture I used for this archive illustrated Dante's Satan, a medieval picture showing the demon's bat wings and the three figures stuck in his or its mouth. A gruesome picture for that gruesome, drooling idiot at the center of hell and of the earth. How horrible, this person commented. And I hope everyone knows that, this person says, I hope everyone knows that hellfire torment is not a Bible teaching. She went on to speak about the Hebrew and Greek words for the afterlife, which imply a consciousness of nothing, just an empty sleep. Yeah, that's okay, but a little defensive, I thought. And I replied pretty gently, I think. Remember, I said, this is a poem, not a dogma, and Dante is describing states of the human soul. We do not take this literally, but instead engage our deep poetic imagination. Well, my correspondent took the point, but still thought it was a horrible idea, this tormenting hell after death. She just wanted, she explained, to make sure that nobody thought it came from the Bible. Well, actually, a lot of it does come from the Bible, though not in the ways she understood the Bible. The Inferno is strewn with imagery and characters taken from all over the Bible, as well as imagery and characters from ancient myth and from history and from Dante's current politics. But we have to remember that when we read a great piece of literature like this, we are consenting to enter the Hermes field, the dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms that might work on us in ways we never anticipated. My correspondent was taking this literally. Well, maybe that's understandable if she had no experience of Dante before, or perhaps even of great poetry. And that's exactly what will lead us in the wrong direction with Dante, who is not setting out a map of what literally happens to the soul after death, but is giving us poetic images of the states of the human soul when we consent to unruly passions or violence or fraud. You appreciate, I hope, that I was not condemning this person, just trying somehow to negotiate her literalism, which seemed to lead to her need to let the world know what the Bible does and does not say. I'm sorry she jumped in with these comments before even listening to the show, but I can see that she was just alarmed. The picture and the blurb for the show hit a sore point, and she quickly responded. I could have responded in the way Robert Bly responds to an imaginary reader at the beginning of his book, The Maiden King, where he says, if you as a reader adore a literalism, you might as well close the book now, because you'll argue with our Sallies so often that it will be bad for your health. That's witty, but perhaps too dismissive. You're never quite sure whom you're speaking to on Facebook. And it's always best to take the gentler, more respectful path. I hope I was gentle and respectful. Though on second thoughts, gentle respect is often the last thing Hermes cares about. Robert Bly's snide remark captures the Hermes spirit better than I did. But then, Bly is always more mischievous and poetic than I am. Here he is, in fact.
The Dingy Playing Cards. Friends, it's time to give up our hope for rapture. Saucers will not carry us away. Raskolnikov had to depend on the police to help him sleep. Our soul loves the dingy cards that have been dealt to the ne'er-do-wells. The old men put the old queens down with their smoke-stained fingers. In the Cirque du Soleil, when the acrobats sweep out over the crowd, babies are being born who know much more than we ever did. The yellow teeth of old jackrabbits explains a lot about the shortage of mercy. And the caterpillar's walk reminds us of the Mongols galloping toward Korakhan. The yellow teeth of old jackrabbits explains a lot about the shortage of mercy. And the caterpillar's walk reminds us of the Mongols galloping toward Korakhan. After the funeral, once they are safe, the dead begin to miss losing at cards. We know that Cain and Abel want to meet each other again on the plowed field. Robert, there's not a single humiliation that we could have done without. There's not a single humiliation we could have done without. We are still perched on the pole. What will happen to us depends a lot on the wind.
There we had Robert Bly performing for us his poem, The Dingy Playing Cards, with musical accompaniment from David Whetstone and Marcus Wise. If we read the poem literally, as we might, for instance, read a textbook or the newspaper, we will be frustrated and pissed off. It will be, as Bly said, bad for our health. So we can just reject the poem. Or as we did at the beginning of our show this evening, we could just let go of trying to capture the poem and allow it to capture us through its sounds and its imagery, its music and its metaphors. This poem does not tell a story. It's not a narrative. It does not express any deep emotions. It's not a lyric. It's in part a little conversation, as he begins by addressing us in the first line, "Friends, it's time to give up our hope for a rapture." A little drama between him and us. What is this rapture? He takes the fundamentalist 19th century notion that all of God's favorites will be drawn up to heaven at the end times, safe now from all the pains and troubles of this world. But he's not really addressing the fundamentalists as his friends. He's addressing all of us who, taking this metaphorically, all of us who hope to have some magical, supernatural solution to all our day-to-day problems. Saucers will not carry us away, he says. And then comes a succession of one-line statements that present us with images to mull over, images that may or may not resonate within us, all having something to do with the value that can come to us from losing, as opposed to being gloriously and effortlessly saved by the rapture or by some flying saucer, and the unity and even healing that can come through pain. These images then lead to a final return to a dramatic encounter, but this time it seems the encounter is just between Robert Bly and Robert Bly, as he addresses not friends but Robert, to say, "Robert, there's not a single humiliation that we could have done without." How often do we hear praise for humiliations? And yet humiliation humbles us, and humbled, we are open to all the new things Hermes has in store for us. Life's a mystery, a precarious game, dependent much more on the wind or spirit than we usually think. "We are still perched on the pole," Bly concludes. "What will happen to us depends a lot on the wind."
Friends, it's time to give up our hope for a rapture. Saucers will not carry us away. Raskolnikov had to depend on the police to help him sleep. Our soul loves the dingy cards that have been dealt to the ne'er-do-wells. The old men put the old queens down with their smoke-stained fingers. In the Cirque du Soleil, when the acrobats sweep out over the crowd, babies are being born who know much more than we ever did. The yellow teeth of old jackrabbits explains a lot about the shortage of mercy. And the caterpillar's walk reminds us of the Mongols galloping toward Khorakhan. The yellow teeth of old jackrabbits explains a lot about the shortage of mercy. And the caterpillar's walk reminds us of the Mongols galloping toward Khorakhan. After the funeral, once they are safe, the dead begin to miss losing at cards. We know that Cain and Abel want to meet each other again on the plowed field. Robert, there's not a single humiliation that we could have done without. There's not a single humiliation we could have done without. We are still perched on a pole. What will happen to us depends a lot on the wind.
And so, what dingy playing cards are you putting down on the table today? Are you a ne'er-do-well? Our soul loves you, Bly says. That's probably because our soul knows that we, too, are ne'er-do-wells. And ne'er-do-wells, I think, are under the special charge of the god Hermes, or Mercury. Apollo is for all those who excel, those who have triumphed in war, sports, or the arts, who are crowned with Apollo's wreath of laurel leaves. The Hermes person is the one far behind the finishing line who stumbled in a little dip, a mini cave, in the track and is limping back with an injured ankle, having been led through this injury, we hope, on a much richer and deeper journey than the Apollonic winner up there. Now, to sum up much of what we've been saying, let's take a moment to run through the different aspects of Hermes. Here's a list. Hermes is the god of travelers, crossroads, and gateways, and therefore moments of metamorphosis and transformation. He's the shapeshifter, the trickster, the one you can never predict, much less control. He's the god of cleverness, cleverness in the arts as an orator, the manipulator of words, and also of the other arts like sounds and colors and shapes, and cleverness in machinery and thus technology, cleverness in sports, the tennis player who makes it look like she's about to slam the ball hard but just taps it gently over the net. Or the cleverness in war, with feints and sneak attacks and undermining the enemy's position. Prostitutes belong to Hermes, too, and it's no accident that they call the people they deal with their tricks. And gamblers, too, of course. And he's a phallic god. What part of the human body is trickier than the phallus? In Greek times, there used to be statues called Hermes, perhaps waist-high blocks of stone, on top of which would be a half-statue of Hermes, from the groin up with an erection. To be found at crossroads and other auspicious parts of one's path. And I think people walking past would have given it a stroke as they passed, just for good luck. The generative organ, tricksy but procreative. But this god of border crossings also crosses gender boundaries, and with his connection to dark, unfolding caves, he's also the deity of the yoni. In all this, we can see that Hermes is the messenger god, though never a straightforward messenger. Zeus had his doubts about making Hermes his messenger. "You're a notorious liar," he said. Hermes replied, "Whether I tell them the truth or tell them a lie, they'll get the message." This is nonsense to a literalist, but to anyone alert to the indirection of a metaphor, it makes perfect sense. And last, arising out of all this, Hermes is the psychopomp, the one who after death leads the soul to the underworld, leads us, after our humiliation, after that death of a part of our ego, leads us into our deep unconscious world, like Dante descending into the inferno to rise up again healed. Or as the onecopomp, the one who leads us into the world of dreams, which in their own indirect way put us in touch with the unconscious truths within us. And always with a surprise, as we recognize something that's been there all the time. And speaking of surprise, here we are surprised and being tripped up in a Hermes way as we come now to the end of our time together this evening under lamplight. We've covered a lot of tricky ground this evening, and we could have covered more. But come back next time in a 14 night to Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here on Cambridge 105. And catch our archives at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or reach me at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk. On Facebook, we're known as Moments Under Lamplight. Be my friend. And now, let's go out with a scherzo, Hermes' favorite kind of music, from Beethoven's Second Piano Sonata. Good night.